Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. We're now on episode number 857. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, at Reformed Forum headquarters, and very excited to be discussing Presbyterian history with none other than Danny Olinger, who serves as the General Secretary for the OPC's Committee on Christian Education. Welcome, Danny. It's great to see you.
Hey, it's great to see you, Camden.
Yes, we're in the thick of it. I think the transfer window is closed. I mean, you and I always have our college football discussions. And I don't know what's going on in the world of college football because Michigan hired an Ohio State coach. We took an Ohio State basketball player. So what is this? Dogs and cats playing together? I mean, you've taken our coaches before, and I guess the Michigan has probably had some Ohio State coaches before, but whatever, the world's upside down and we're going to start paying players directly. Who knows what's going on? It's crazy town.
Yeah. As an Ohio State fan, we're kind of staying low right now. The last 3 years have not been good. So
the previous 15 weren't good for Michigan. So. I think we have an edge in the overall series, but as the Alabama fans are so quick to remind the Michigan fans that, yeah, all these wins with leather helmets don't really count. So anyway, all-time winningest program, but we'll see what happens. Big day. My household, my children and I are very much looking forward to July when the new EA Sports college football game comes out. It's been on hold for 10 years, so it's going to come back. And now you can pay players. You don't have to worry about lawsuits from college athletes who are featured in the game. So we're looking forward to that. And my productivity might go down in July, but I'll have to put myself on a budget just like my kids are on a budget, screen time budget. Anyway, today we've got some great stuff. We're going to be speaking about the Auburn Affirmation, which is a document that was written kind of in response to the five fundamentals being reaffirmed at the 1923 General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church. We'll get into more of those details. I do want to mention a few things before we get started. We've got a busy season coming up. As Danny knows, we've got General Assembly, the OPC, in June, but I'll also be attending the PCA General Assembly, as well as making a pit stop at the URCNA General Synod in Escondido on my way to Seattle to go to the OPC's GA. So it's going to be a busy June, but we're really excited to see lots of people. If you'd like to stop by, we're going to have a booth at PCA GA. I will be at the URC GA or General Synod, and I will be at the OPC General Assembly the entire time. We're not going to be having a booth at the OPC General Assembly, but I'll be there and would be happy to talk. So if you're at any of those assemblies or would like to stop by, please do and connect. I'd love to meet you. Love to talk with you. If you want some more information or have any particular questions, hit us up at mail@reformedforum.org. I also want to encourage people to take a look at our website for other upcoming events, as well as new courses that we've recorded and other programs and episodes and publications. That's the place to be. Subscribe to the email newsletter. And when you do so, if you haven't already, if you've subscribed to it already, you've already received an email with a PDF link. If you haven't subscribed, sign up and you'll get a PDF to our latest magazine. We send out a free magazine. We used to call it a newsletter, a print newsletter, but it's kind of got big enough where, 16 pages, 24 pages, one issue was. We started to realize this is more than just a newsletter. And we include articles in there too, so it's not just news. And in the latest issue, we feature three articles on various topics on confessional subscription. We've got one by Alan Strange on the Animus Impenitentis. We have one by Tim Squeers talking about confessional fidelity and subscription in Geneva, particularly with Calvin. And then I wrote an article reflecting on the Auburn Affirmation at 100. We're memorializing. I can't say we're celebrating, but we're remembering the Auburn Affirmation 100 years later. It was written, drafted around January 1924. Late, maybe December 23, but it really came to bear largely in May 1924. So right now, when this episode comes out, it's roughly about 100 years when the Auburn Affirmation hit its fever pitch. So subscribe to the email newsletter, and or if you have received, if you're one of the 4,000 or 5,000 people out there who've gotten received the magazine in the mail by now, read my article. You'll be well up to date. Last thing to mention, while you're at it, consider supporting to Reform Forum. Head on over to reformforum.org/donate. Just a reminder that we produce and distribute all of our programs and all of our video courses, up to 25 video courses now we produce and distribute around the world entirely for free. We also are very much involved in publishing books and other resources, and as much as possible, we seek to make those affordable. And our pamphlets and other stuff we're seeking to send out to people that are in need. But a lot of this comes at great expense. So we also encourage you to visit reformedforum.org to pledge your support today. We thank you so much that the number of donors to Reform Forum over the last couple of years has been growing every year. But we still have a great need and a monthly deficit. We're not in debt. We still have some initial funding that we're still drawing upon. But in terms of what comes in and what goes out every month, we are in significant need. So we encourage you to visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate to pledge your support and help us out. And if you'd like to talk to any of us here, myself or Ryan Noah, our Director of Development and Education, we'd love to speak with you and talk about our projects, our future mission and our vision, the programs we have ahead, and how you can help. Contact us at mail@reformedforum.org. Thank you so much for your support of everything we're doing here at Reformed Forum. Danny, let's turn our attention now to the subject at hand. The Auburn Affirmation, a very significant event in Presbyterian history, although one that, you know, maybe people have heard in a seminary course or it's come up. Maybe they've read about it as they've been reading, you know, Fighting the Good Fight or the biography of J. Gresham Machen by Ned Stonehouse or some other Presbyterian documents. But I imagine very few people would be able to tell you the substance of it, what it was about, and even fewer people would be able to tell you why it came about. One book I have, which I don't even know if we have an electronic copy of this, but we should bring this back into print. It's The Auburn Betrayal by Murray Forrest Thompson, was a ruling elder at Calvary OPC in Glenside. He was an attorney. He defended the OPC in their lawsuit when they were sued for naming themselves the Presbyterian Church of America. And I like to think that he would have won the case. They just ran out. He didn't have enough time. They just ran out of money. Well, that's my interpretation of history. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But he certainly was an ardent defender of the faith, of the Orthodox, Reformed, confessional faith. He and Van Til were the two minority signers of a minority report for the Committee of Nine. So he has a place in my heart. I have a lot of affection for Murray Forrest Thompson. But this book is something because he writes a history of the Auburn Affirmation, what led up to it, what happened, and then he also includes the entire Auburn Affirmation so that it's on file, and then he includes a list of everyone who signed it so that the history books have this recorded. It has their name and their city and state. So I'm thankful that I have not found any pastors of the church where I grew up having signed it. I don't know if that was principled or if they just didn't know about it, but about 10% of the Presbyterian ministers at the time signed this document. And that's a big, big, big deal. Danny, what would you say just in general about introducing people to the Auburn Affirmation? I don't know. Where would you put this on the scale of significance, not only for the scope of American Presbyterians, but especially for Orthodox Presbyterians?
I think it probably functions as a marker when the coalition that existed in the Presbyterian Church was just totally severed. And if you go back to 1870, the reunion that had taken place between the old school and the new school following the completion of the Civil War, you had a coalition that existed. And that coalition included liberals, conservatives, and also those who would be moderate. And I think by the time you get to the Auburn Affirmation, that's when it's done. I mean, I think this is the marker for when everything has splintered in that regard.
Right, and there's a lot of background to this. You're mentioning the mid to late-ish 19th century. I don't know if you'd like to dig into there. I'd be happy to camp out there and talk more, because I've, you know, at least in my research and where I start, it's kind of looking back more to the publication of The Fundamentals. But let's not get there yet. Tell us more about the late 19th century and the splintering. What's coming to bear in the Presbyterian Church?
Yeah, maybe if we could focus it on two individuals, two ruling elders in the Presbyterian Church in 1915, two ruling elders. One ruling elder would be Woodrow Wilson, who's the president of the United States. So he is the son of an old school Presbyterian, but he goes to Princeton College and spends a year there and hates the fact that it's an evangelical Bible school. Just driving him crazy. He wants to study in his room and people are knocking on his door about revival. And so when he comes back as a faculty member 20 years later, he has a vision of transforming Princeton. And he gets that opportunity in 1902 when he becomes president. So Woodrow Wilson is a progressive in both politics and theology, in that he believes that the progress of culture is the progress in advance of the kingdom of God on earth. And he has no confidence in the Bible or doctrine. He doesn't care one whit about traditional doctrine. He believes through action, political action, there's going to Christianize the world. And America is the machine to do that. So he's the president. That's one ruling elder. He appoints as his Secretary of State another ruling elder in the Presbyterian Church, William Jennings Bryan. So William Jennings Bryan was a Cumberland Presbyterian. The official motto of the Cumberland Presbyterian Church at the turn of the century was "Save America to save the world."
Oh no!
So this is the absolute fever-pitched sense that American culture is the kingdom. And Bryan believed that with all of his heart. Now, he was equally at home then in politics and in the church. And so he was the Democratic nominee for president three times, 1896, 1900, 1908. But by the third time he got defeated, he turned to helping Wilson get the nomination in 1912. And so Wilson ends up giving him the Secretary of State job, even though they politically were apart. This all fractures in 1915 when Bryan does not want America to enter into World War I, and he resigns as Secretary of State. And I say this because it's somewhat symbolic of also what's going on in the Presbyterian Church, because Bryan was a social gospeler. He believed in that, but he also believed in the Bible. He believed in the miracles. He believed in all the traditional doctrine. So the coalition was, here are two post-mills. One totally couldn't stand the Bible, but was Christian and wanted to Christianize the world. The other believed the Bible, but he loved the social gospel and could care less about doctrine also, unless it affected culture. And they had formed this coalition, but now the war was driving them apart. But it was not just politically that this was a separation that was happening. There was a separation happening in the church, because there were those conservatives who were so alarmed by what was happening to the crumbling of culture and Christian influence and culture and identification, that they took to particularly an oil man by the name of Lyman Stewart. Helped finance The Fundamentals, which came out and were written by all sorts of scholars. And it was an attempt to really defend the traditional faith. He was a dispensationalist. He created the Biblical Institute of Los Angeles, which we now know as BIOLA, the acronym. But he had been financing this And at the same time, there was trouble in the Presbyterian Church, particularly with the Presbytery of New York. And it often comes back throughout this whole controversy, the Presbytery of New York.
Yeah.
Presbytery of New York was affluent. This is where most of the money was in the Presbyterian Church. This is, where a lot of the movers and shakers in culture were. And this was the most liberal presbytery, probably, in the Presbyterian Church. And so Union Seminary, in the Briggs controversy, had severed its relationship with the Presbyterian Church in 1893. But it was still sending its graduates to the Presbyterian Church, and particularly to the Presbytery of New York. And in 1910, there were those in the church that wanted the Presbytery of New York to do something about those who were denying, in their opinion, denying the faith. And so the 1910 General Assembly passed these five fundamentals that were on inerrancy and miracles and the second coming and atonement and the virgin birth. They passed that. And so that sort of set the stage for what was going to happen in the next 15 years in regard to the clash, at least at the General Assembly level, between the liberals and the conservatives. Not maybe getting ahead of myself here, but in the latest Reform Forum issue that you talked about, Alan Strange makes the great point that this was probably a very, very poor move by the General Assembly, because whenever you truncate something like this, it becomes a creed within a creed. It becomes a confession within a confession, and it opens you up later to constitutional questions if you had the ability to do that.
Right. So there are some people, I have a tiny bit of sympathy for some of the affirmationists on a superficial level, just formally, and it's on the point that you just mentioned. Now, as we unpack this and dig down into what the Auburn Affirmation was actually doing, I think we're going to find that we don't have much sympathy for it. But in principle, some people were arguing that we can't create these extra documents. We already have confessional statements. So why are we creating these other confessional statements that serve as a litmus test for what we already have? And it should not be up to the assembly to be doing these kinds of things, but it rather should, fall to presbyteries. And so you can kind of see where, okay, we kind of get this to a degree. But when we start to figure out what the substance of these arguments are and what they had a problem with, it's pretty ridiculous. So you mentioned already the General Assembly of 1910 in the Northern Church, of course, affirmed the five fundamentals. These were distilled. First, the inerrancy of the Holy Scriptures. Secondly, the virgin birth of Jesus Christ. Thirdly, the vicarious atonement of Jesus, so that his death for sinners to pay for sin. Fourth, the reality of the bodily resurrection of Christ. And then fifth, the actuality of the miracles of Jesus. The affirmation is affirming, well, they're not saying, all the affirmationists are trying to say is that we don't necessarily disagree with these traditional understandings. However, there should be greater latitude for other theories of how to explain the Bible. So that's really what's at stake. They're saying, yes, we recognize that some people believe Jesus died to pay for sins, or that the miracles are true, the Bible's inspired, he was born of a virgin, and that he was raised from the dead physically. But there are other ways to explain the Bible as well. And we see this come to bear, perhaps, I hope we're not jumping ahead too fast, but in 1922, with the famous sermon, Shall the Fundamentalist Win, which was delivered by Harry Emerson Fosdick. So I believe we've had episodes where we've talked about this particular event, but would you mind reminding people just in a snapshot form what Fosdick did and why that raised such a ruckus in the Presbyterian Church?
Fosdick was a Baptist preacher. He was also connected with Union Seminary. And Fosdick believed, particularly with soldiers returning home from World War I, that if the church preached to these contemporary individuals who had just fought the war, if it preached traditional Christianity, it would lose the whole generation. So he believed that you absolutely must update what you were teaching. He believed that doctrine was only the sentiments of a particular age. So the Westminster Confession was just the thoughts of that which was in the 17th century. It really, for us, we had different doctrines, and
It's like a
so.
historicized interpretation that it's kind of like what Rahner used to say, Chalcedon's all great and all, but we need a new Christology for an evolutionary view of the world. We need to update the doctrine for whatever we're going through. And so postmodernism, now we're living in a modern world, these 17th century documents, they were good for then, but we need something new now.
Right. So he's in the pulpit of one of the most historic churches in all the land. First Presbyterian Church, New York, had been established in 1716, only a decade after Presbyterianism came to America. And so he is the pulpit supply there, and he preaches this sermon, and he goes after what he believes is the issue in the church, which is that the fundamentalists are making war on those of us who have different views. And since he didn't care about doctrine anyhow, he was like, what are you doing? But not only that, he didn't it put it better, since he philosophically did not believe the that what the traditional understanding of the Westminster
Right.
standards put forth. After the Auburn
And he
Affirmation,
wasn't
one year.
held to them either. He's a Baptist. He's just preaching it, as you mentioned. So he's also not, he hasn't taken oaths to them or taken an oath to subscribe to it, and he's not on accountable to them. That's one of the big problems too.
So 3 years later, when he actually left, when he actually was there was an invitation for him to join the Presbyterian Church, and there's no way he's going to do it. He said, look, this was his confession. This was not Machen. This is not anyone else. Fosdick said openly, if you judge me by the standards of traditional orthodoxy, I'm a heretic. He said that. Okay, so he's arguing here for tolerance, quote, tolerance. Even though he has no tolerance whatsoever for those who agree with, he would differ with that. But look at the language. Look what he's doing. Look what he's equating. He's basically saying liberals, progressives are the party of love. And that's the main attribute that Christianity is all about. These fundamentalists, they're basically the party of the Pharisees. They have no love for others. All they're concerned about is something that's outdated and primitive, and has nothing to do with the evangelization of the world here and now. So he preaches that sermon on May 21st, 1922. There was an advertising executive in New York who had it spread throughout the entire country. Plus, Fosdick had an admirer in New York City, John Rockefeller Jr., who desperately wanted Fosdick to be his preacher at the Riverside Church. And he would end up getting him, after he left. So this gets spread throughout the entire country, this sermon. And it comes to the attention, obviously, then of Presbyterians in Philadelphia, particularly Clarence McCartney, the pastor at Arch Street, who then replies in the sermon, "Shall unbelief win?" And also has his presbytery, the Presbytery of Philadelphia, complain against the Presbytery of New York in regard to what's going on in the pulpit of a First Presbyterian Church in New York City.
Right. And this leads to a sequence of events and eventually comes to the General Assembly in 1923, correct? And then they reaffirm the five fundamentals that they had affirmed in 1910. What else happened in that intervening time period? And really, what was the character or the tone of the 1923 General Assembly?
Well, there's a reason why I started with William Jennings Bryan, because he is a major player. He is probably the major player in the 1923 General Assembly. So Woodrow Wilson ends up with the war, League of Nations proposal, which is to Christianize the world, that gets adopted officially endorsed by the PC USA General Assembly in 1919. But then Wilson has a stroke. But with Bryant, he has a second life in the church, because by this point, he's identified what the main culprit was to American culture, and it's Darwinism. So interestingly, in 1921, he speaks in Richmond at the Sprunk Lectures on Darwinism in October. In February of that year, they had J. Gresham Machen speak on the origin of Paul's religion.
Wow.
So in that lecture series. But Bryant was on the lecture circuit, and he came to the 1923 assembly wanting to be the moderator. And so he was one of four candidates. It was in Indianapolis. And he wanted to really drive home the evils of Darwinism. He also wanted to pass a resolution to support total abstinence, since he had been probably culture's main promoter of getting the 18th Amendment passed. So he gets there, and there's four candidates. And one of the candidates is going to represent the progressives. He's a respected man. He's the president of Worcester College in Ohio, not far from where I grew up. His name was Charles Wishart. And they start the balloting process. First ballot, Bryant has a majority, but doesn't have enough to be moderator. Second ballot, so you drop a name after the lowest one. Second ballot, Bryant, again, has majority, doesn't have enough. You come down to the third ballot, only him and Wishart. Wishart wins. Thunderous applause in the assembly that Bryant didn't get elected, which is a tip-off of where the Presbyterian Church is in relationship to him at this time. Because there's a sense in which he's an embarrassment to what's going on. So he still thinks he has this political power in and outside of the church, because he had just been called by the Christian Century prior to the assembly as the most important layman in the Presbyterian Church. So he's coming in with this, like, you know, he's always been confident. So he's sitting there thinking, you know, what, he wants the prime assignment of being the chairman of the Bills and Overtures Committee, but he ends up waiting too long. And so the moderator who assigns him puts him on home missions. So the Bills and Overtures Committee, the Bills and Overture Committee has 23 men, and 22 of them, of the majority report, is that let the commission that's been assigned by the Presbytery of New York do their work in the Fosdick matter. Now, you can read in some of J. Gresham Machen's articles at the time just how outrageous that commission was. The Presbytery is just out to lunch. I think even those who are sympathetic would read this and say, "What? This is the greatest Homer job you've ever seen in your life to protect anyone." And so it's just outrageous. So so yet, if you are a presbyter and you're coming from Wyoming, how do you know this? And things like this. But one person who did know was from the Presbytery of Philadelphia. His name was Gordon McClendon. And he obviously, McCartney was talking in his ear. And he wrote a minority report. And that minority report then became the basis in which Bryant and others started to, you know, go back and forth with. And they ended up doing two things. One was they wanted to reaffirm the fundamentals that had been passed by the 1910 and 1916 General Assembly. And secondly, they wanted to direct the Presbytery of New York to have First Presbyterian Church have its preaching and teaching conform to the Westminster standards that the Presbyterian Church upholds. You know, a radical suggestion that they might actually conform to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that ends up passing. One man, The Minority Report, that ends up passing at this assembly. After the assembly ends, a month after the assembly ends, the progressives get together. And there was a professor at Auburn Seminary, Robert Hastings Nichols, who had written a paper that Kaufman and others were aware of that they thought could become the basis for a response to what had happened at the assembly. And particularly, they thought it was time to turn the table on the conservatives, or the fundamentalists, as they called them, in the church. And in many ways, it was ingenious. Because you mentioned earlier in regard to the language of the document, the Auburn Affirmation. They worked on it for the next 5 months. They signed it in December, released it in January. I think they were, I mean, I know historians disagree on this at points, but I think the records show that they really wanted to get moderates, particularly evangelicals who didn't want to fight about doctrine, into their midst, and they were disingenuous with their language. They were saying one thing, but they were meaning another. And this was, I say this not as a unique interpretation. This was an interpretation at the very time the document was released, not by J. Gresham Machen, but by Charles Eliot and other Unitarians. He had been the president of Harvard, who had taken a look at what was happening, and they have no love for conservative Presbyterianism. And they said, look, this document's doing two things that are pretty outrageous. One is, if you're a member of a church and you have a creed, basic honesty is you uphold that creed that you've already subscribed to. But the second thing is, there's a decency about using language in a way in which you mislead people, so that people read it one way when you have a meaning that's another way. That was Charles Eliot in the statement that came out at the time. I think that's the proper read on this. So those who are pro Auburn Affirmation people, historians and others, they would say, well, this was just good. This was something that was just very wise, because they made concessions, and the concessions won them the moderates. I don't disagree with that, but I'm saying underneath those concessions, it was deceptive.
It's disingenuous.
And
Yeah, we have to maintain, I try to make this point in my article. We have to maintain both confessional fidelity and integrity. And I think there's two things here. And I think that the affirmationists who understood the point of the affirmation are really affirming neither. Because fidelity would be interpreting the document on its own terms. So we're going to be faithful to what the document actually says. We're not twisting it. We're not saying it means something other than what it means. We need to maintain that, no, this is what this statement meant, what it means, what the confession says, and what they meant by it. But then there's the confessional integrity, which means that I'm going to subscribe to this ex animo from the heart, and I'm going to seek to abide by what this document says. So you can see people messing up on both ends. One, they say, well, I subscribe to the document, but I interpret it completely differently. And then you have other people who say, well, I know what this says, but I cross my fingers when I subscribe. I'm a minister in this church, but I don't really believe it. And so you get both of those kinds of groups in here. And then you get this huge soft middle that is signing on, which are people that say, well, we know that we have all disagreements about things, and these guys are good guys. I like them. I get along with them. And we don't want to kick anyone out. These people say, well, I'm a more conservative. I agree with the fundamentals, but I understand we should have some breadth of understanding here, and let's have a big tent and be accepting. Let's have tolerance. Those are the kinds of people that they're trying to get to sign this thing, is those are the kinds of people that will allow liberal interpretations to exist. And once those liberal interpretations can take root, then eventually the people can flip this whole church to be liberal. But there are folks like Murray Forrest Thompson, J. Gresham Machen, Clarence McCartney, all these other folks that recognize what's actually going on under the surface, that this isn't just a procedural point at heart, that we don't have rock-ribbed Westminster confession people who just want to stick to the confession and don't want a summary of it. No, these are folks that either don't have confessional integrity or confessional fidelity, and many people who had neither of the two.
Yeah, and as you point out in the article, and also Alan's article, one of the things that they led with was the 1729 Adopting Act. And actually, when you go back and look at it, what was happening there was, you know, as the Presbyterian Church was going to adopt the Constitution, the question was, in regard to subscription, there were the anti-subscriptionists and there were subscriptionists, and they're trying to find the middle ground, and they ended up affirming subscription. Charles Briggs took a great interest in the Adopting Act, had chronicled, had written major things about it. He came unbelievably to the other conclusion. He came to seeing the Adopting Act as the triumph of liberty and the anti-subscriptionists. So again, you can't overplay the influence Briggs is having in regard to the press trade of New York. And one of the things that's really fascinating when you do the research is the counsel for Union Seminary at the Briggs trial was Henry Sloan Coffin's father.
Hmm.
And he took 16-year-old Henry to every trial thing that was going on. And that's where Briggs became Coffin's hero.
Hmm.
And that's where, you know, he basically was following the path in regard to Briggs. For Coffin's famous definition of liberalism, he did this at Union Seminary in 1915, is basically liberalism is adapting Christianity so that the modern man understands. That's a paraphrase.
Mm.
But, you know, he is basically whatever it takes to get moderns to believe, that's what we should do.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it comes to then the Auburn Affirmation, they are touting this inclusivist nature, and they use the Adopting Act, which is disputed by Machen and McCartney, but no one's disputing that the Presbyterian Church in 1870 with the reunion had that there was inclusive principles there. Charles Hodge was outraged by it, you know, what happened in 1870. And he said, this is setting the stage for something bad. And in 1906, when the Cumberland Presbyterian Church came back in after the confessional revision, because the Calvinism had been lessened, it was, again, the Auburn Affirmation document is right in those two regards. But in regard to what you're saying, and this is what Machen's argument goes. So Machen says, look, there is the constitutional question. But he says, don't you notice it immediately gets into content?
Sure.
And Machen's mm-hmm. so brilliant here. And he says, look, is the virgin birth a mere theory? Do you know what you're saying? You're saying someone can say that the Mary was, that Jesus supernaturally conceived, and someone else can say that there's a human father, and the Bible teaches both. And Machen's saying that's absurd, and he's right.
Absolutely. Yeah, either he was raised from the dead physically or not. I mean, that it teaches one or the other. The Bible clearly is emphatic that Jesus was raised from the dead, and that's essential to the gospel message. It's essential to the faith. But there are people denying that and saying, well, maybe he didn't. Maybe it was just a spiritual resurrection. Maybe it's a metaphor for, you know, transcending our human and earthly limitations. And that's what the affirmationists want to provide latitude for, people that believe that.
Yeah, I think I when I was thinking about reading Getting Ready for This, I was thinking about your ministry, your work here at Reform Forum. And how it does connect so much here, because ultimately, the defense that Machen is making is about the great redemptive acts in history. And now you can have no gospel without the great redemptive acts in history, and then our defense of those going forward. And in that sense, I really think that this is where you start to see the great influence of Gerhardus Voss upon Machen and his training. So that led me to go back. And what I did is
Yes.
I put Machen's materials about the Alverman Affirmation side by side with Voss's great article, The Christian Faith and the Truthfulness of Bible History. And that had happened when Machen was just graduating from Princeton Seminary. But if I could read some quotes from you, from this is from Voss's article, and tell me not if this doesn't sound like Machen.
Is this no
So this is
1915?
the address was in 1905,
Oh
Christian
five.
Faith and the Truthfulness of Bible History. This is some of the things I've written down. So this is Voss. It is perfectly well understood that where the great supernatural facts are allowed to enter or to remain as the necessary correlates of faith, there the doctrines cannot be consistently kept out. For what else are the doctrines but the theological interpretation of the facts? So that's Machen's whole thing.
Oh, that's
That
his big
you
problem.
can't, yeah. Yeah, it's you cannot divorce factualness of Christianity from doctrine. They go together. And that's also Fantel. This is what Voss says next. It is safe to say that a Christianity which plants itself squarely upon the foundation of supernatural history will always be a doctrinal Christianity and vice versa. So again, why is Fosdick and Coffin and everyone else trying to neuter this? They don't want a doctrinal Christianity. They see it as a hindrance to the evangelization of the modern world. The Bible has been discredited. That's what the 19th century had taught them, that it couldn't stand up to the scientific methodology. And so they're looking for something that will appeal to modern ears. Voss says, people no longer have to say Christianity must be possible without belief in the facts, for the facts have become uncertain and religion is a necessity. They are now able to say Christianity, from its very essence, as we construe it, can dispense with the facts. And if history fails to authenticate them, this makes us neither cold nor warm, because our faith is superior to such considerations. I mean, that's literally, you could see
Right.
Machen saying that very thing. I got a couple more here. I know this is exciting on YouTube, seeing someone, just read quotes, but this is the ones that really get me, and this is where I think you understand Gerhardus Voss. Then you start to understand J. Gresham Machen and Cornelius Fantel, and even us and the Orthodox Presbyterians. The difference between those who think they can do without the facts and us who feel that we must have the facts does not lie on the periphery of the Christian faith. It touches what is to us is the center. It relates to nothing less than the claim of our holy re religion to be a supernatural religion, and a religion which objectively saves from sin. And that's the one thing you never hear the Auburn Affirmation people talking
No,
about.
no.
You never want to get into anthropology. You never want to get into sin. You never want to get into judgment. That's why they just appealed to attacking substitutionary atonement. And that had been a staple of Auburn Seminary back to the 19th century, that attack upon limited atonement. But what Voss is saying is there's no gospel unless Jesus, the Son of God, supernaturally conceived, who came, died an atoning death, rose from the dead, and will come again. There's no gospel. And then this is the last one I'll read. But this is one that I think is where Voss, has us being the writing on Machen's shoulders and Fantel's going forward. This is what he does not develop in the article, but I think puts the program out for all who for those who have followed, it would be easy to show that a Christianity which can dispense with the facts of the Bible history must, from the nature of the case, be a religion confined by the horizon of the present life and the present world, lacking that supernatural naturalistic outlook which is so characteristic of the biblical religion as a whole and of historic Christianity as well. And there's the issue that really doesn't get talked about in the history books. It's the eschatology of what's going on. J. Gerson Machen was amillennial. J. Gerson Machen believed that the kingdom of God was both present and future. He wasn't confining it to Christian America as if the kingdom was coming on earth and that we were heading towards this golden period. He was amillennial. He confesses that from basically the last 15 years of his life in various places. What you have going on in the Presbyterian Church is basically, at the turn of the century, post-mills fighting with each other. Liberal post-mills fighting with conservative post-mills in regard to how to bring about the kingdom. But then World War I comes about, and that introduces the pre-mills, particularly the dispensationalists. So Lyman Stewart doesn't just fund the fundamentals. He also funds the reissuing of William Blackstone's Jesus Is Coming, which was the great dispensational book written in 1878. In 1916, it's the best-selling book in America. So you have now the dispensationalists entering the Presbyterian Church, and they now are having a different motive for evangelization. If the post-mills wanted to evangelize to bring the kingdom of God on earth, the pre-mills wanted to evangelize dispensationalists to save people from a sinking ship. And J. Gerson Machen is saying, no, he's saying, look, the liberal option is much worse than the dispensational option, but no, that's not what we're called to. Is to preach the gospel, and that is the means of grace in which by people are converted, and we are those who belong to a heavenly kingdom now, even as we wait for the consummation of that kingdom in heaven.
Yeah, that's so important to think about Voss and Machen on these points. I'm glad you raised this issue. From my vantage point, see if you agree with this. Certainly, we have with the liberal post mills and the conservative post mills, what they have in common is a tendency to view reality through the lens of this world. So
Yes.
for the liberal, they reduce religion to ethics. So the
Yes.
facts, so this is what Machen's biggest problem with modernism is. It was the fact that they reduced it to a life. And he says it is a life, but it's a life based on doctrine. The doctrine is not the effects of Christianity, but it's the foundation. And that doctrine is based on facts, things that happen, so that the supernatural enters into history, that God acts in history redemptively. This is a fact. These are facts. These things happened, and there's the teaching that we confess and profess is based on these facts, historical facts of the supernatural entering history. That's essential. But the liberal mindset eliminates all the facts in history. It becomes completely unimportant. These just become stories or metaphors for getting at ethical aspects of life so we could follow the life of Jesus and his teachings as one among many other people that we can learn from. But incidentally, the conservative post-mills, although they hold to orthodox doctrine on many things and have no problem with the supernatural acting in history and affirm all these things and affirm the Westminster Standards, they tend to view the success of the advancement of the kingdom through the lens of this world. So political advancement. The United States succeeding politically as a so-called Christian nation is a direct sign. It's a way that you measure whether the gospel is going forward. The numbers of people in your church, your political influence or success, how many people are you know, what donating to your church. All these kinds of things are earthly metrics. They're earthly gauges by which they try to gauge the advancement of the kingdom, which is the flip side of the coin. It's a twin. They're twin. What should I say? Two sides of the same error. And where Machen and Voss are getting into helping us to understand biblical eschatology better and the advancement of the kingdom better is not by saying we hope that the church suffers, but we have an expectation that the church will suffer, and that even if the church is suffering and even if the church is being put to death, we know the gates of hell cannot prevail over God's kingdom, over the church, and the gospel still goes forward in and through this suffering. So outwardly, we can see the church wasting away, but possibly, at least politically, you know, with its influence and all these sorts of things. But inwardly, with the eyes of faith, we can see the unseen realm that God's kingdom still advances. It's a both and that's the amillennial hope. I mean, if I was to write some sort of a counter response to the Puritan hope, Ian Murray's, which there's a lot in that book I love, you know, but at the same time, it's like, we also want to make sure that what we hope for and what we yearn for and what we strive for is the spiritual advancement of the kingdom, which we know, of course, when Christ returns, will consummate in the new heavens and the new earth. So we're not disembodied souls here, that there will be a transformation and a renewal, a consummation on the other side of the fires of judgment. But we need to always remind ourselves that we need to view things with the eyes of faith and not with this worldly eyes, because once we start doing that, we'll make a huge error, either the liberal side of that error or a conservative side of that error, but both of them are bad.
Yeah, that's fair. So that's so well put. I had three things that came to mind. So this is a quote from George Marsden in his great book on fundamentalism and American culture. Marsden said part of the issue during this whole conflict was, he says, quote, "In the pulpit, liberals could not be easily distinguished from conservatives on such practical points, and practical morality was often, for American Protestants, what mattered most." So it was the same message going out in regard to what was being proclaimed. So that's the first thing that comes to mind. Secondly, Machen, to be a little bit more exact in light of his 1912 article on Christianity and culture, Machen didn't want, he's not saying ignore culture. He didn't want to go down the fundamentalist path of ignoring culture, but he was not saying, he's not making this identification of culture one-to-one like the progressives were. He's saying the church must consecrate culture, and the way you consecrate culture is through doctrine and life. It's by believing right doctrine and then living the Christian life, there's a consecration of culture. Thirdly, when it came to the establishment of Westminster Seminary in 1929, look at the eschatological views of his faculty. So you have Cornelius Van Til's Amill, Ned B. Stonehouse is Amill, John Murray is Amill, R.B. Kuyper, who comes a little bit later, is Amill. So who do you have? Elsewise, you have Paul Lilly, who was historic pre-mill, but a libertarian.
Alice, like, who eventually left, right?
Yeah.
He's another.
Yeah, well, Alice, I think, is all mill.
Was he?
Okay. Yes. I think Prophecy in the Church, if that's if that can be taken, he's all mill.
McCray. I'm thinking
McCray.
Of
McCray. McCray is dispensational.
Yeah.
And then Robert Dick Wilson, who, what, lives 4 or 5 months before he dies, is probably the only post-mill. But I don't know much about 20th century Robert Dick Wilson. But here, first of all, it's non-American. Scottish and Dutch are dominant almost, but it's all mill. And that might be a little bit of the influence of the Belgic Confession, in which is all mill in character, because you're not to harbor Jewish dreams of this golden age. But when at the last year of Machen's life, when he was embroiled in an eschatological controversy in the new church, he was making the argument that the Westminster standards, if you had to pin them down, were amillennial in character. And the chief intellectual person on the BP side, H. McAlister Griffith was agreeing with him. Now, Manchin's not going to put this out, I believe, in public because he was of the same mindset of his heroes, Gerhardus Voss and B.B. Warfield. Warfield and Voss did not want to emphasize that they were differing in these things. You know, Dick Gavin talks about that in some of his articles
Stonehouse too.
because all mills and post mills are post mills.
Yeah, of
They
course. The
all
ordering of
see,
events is the same.
yes, they all see the millennium as a present reality and then the coming of Christ over against premillennialism, who believes Christ comes and then you have the millennium. So in that sense, you know, I understand what they're doing, but we who now have 90 years distance on them, 100 years distance on them, they are unapologetically all mill in what they're proclaiming. And it's not to be all mill for all mill's sake. It's like, what is the nature of the kingdom? That's the ultimate question. Whichever, you know, label you give it, what is the nature of the kingdom? And what is our mindset to be? And I believe you can distill Manchin down to and Voss and all and you know Fantilla and others to what I think. You know, when I think about what's going on there, is they had a belief that the glory of God is the dominant thing that's before us in this life. Evangelism is necessary. It's just like justification in the Reformation. There's no gospel without justification. Evangelism, we are called in a Revelation 11 sense to go to the ends of the earth until we die. And that's the reason why the Lord leaves us on this earth.
Right, there's more sheep to
But
call.
yeah, but what's happened in what happened was that even those who loved the Lord and were they had put something over the glory of God, and they were willing then, having it over the glory of God, to compromise the word unto that end. Well, that's not going to hold up in the end. It's a false foundation, and I think they are primarily being driven by the glory of God in all that we do. And how do you know how to glorify and enjoy God? It's through His Word and Spirit. So if you then destroy that foundation, then you're looking at what Psalm 11:3, you know, about the foundations being destroyed. And so I think that's what's up in their willingness to die. I'll give you one last quote. This is what Boss says at the end of this article, Christian Faith and Truthfulness of Bible History. We, for our part, believe, and we say it deliberately, that it were 1,000 times better for the church to be torn and shaken for many years to come by the conflict with criticism than to buy a shameful peace at the stupendous doctrinal sacrifice which such a position involves. Because, you know, if you make this just theories, if you make these redemptive acts of Jesus Christ in just theories, and if you make the Word of God just another book like any other error-filled book, the cost is Christianity. And I think 100 years later, we've seen exactly what has happened to the Presbyterian Church in the USA. They've lost it. I say of no pleasure.
Well, I wanted to ask you that, what the lasting effects are really of the affirmation, or at least the spirit of the Auburn affirmation, and people haven't connected some of the dots already. You know, how should this instruct us moving forward as Presbyterians who want to be faithful to the confession, but also have integrity in how we subscribe to it?
I think that the Auburn Affirmation is helpful because it's a marker. Those who remained in the Presbyterian Church often thought those guys, those people are so militant. Doctrine's not this important. Life's more important than doctrine. Evangelism's more important than doctrine. And they wanted peace. And so that's why you actually
Although
have that in
didn't
the title of the Auburn Affirmation.
Van Til called these guys in 33 through 35. He was writing to his Dutch kindred and Die Reformatie, but Van Til wasn't the only one. But they called him the peace at all costs guys, or the peace at all price guys. And that's it. The last thing they wanted was any conflict. They would throw the confession out if it saved, if it spared them a fight.
And so Manchin is arguing that you can't have the biblical life without doctrine. And he's arguing you can't have the biblical gospel of good news without Jesus Christ dying for our sins according to the scriptures. And so he quotes that over and over again. The Auburn Affirmation came out on January 8th, 1924. The next day in the New York Times, Machen replied. The Times knew that this young author of Christianity Liberalism was the person that they should have the confessional response. And so he replied to the publication of the affirmation. And this is what he wrote at the time and was published in the New York Times, January 9th, 1924. The declaration as a whole is a deplorable attempt to obscure the issue. The plain fact is that two mutually exclusive religions are being proclaimed in the pulpits of the Presbyterian Church. They have been recognized as mutually exclusive by all clear-sighted persons, both radical and conservative. One is the great redemptive religion known as Christianity, a religion founded upon certain supernatural events in the first century of our era. The other is the naturalistic or agnostic modernism, anti-Christian to the core, which is represented by Dr. Fosdick and by some of the signers of the present declaration. Now, what Machen also goes on to do, he doesn't do it there in the New York Times, but he does it in everything else that he writes about this. He goes on to saying, I am not judging an individual's faith. I am not judging what a person might believe. I'm talking about a movement. I'm talking about what, this corporate movement that's taking place, and I'm talking about what the responsibility is of the church, the corporate witness of the church, particularly in the Christian form of church government that Presbyterianism is. And so he's making the case that, this is what we're called to as a church. He's basically saying, let the church be the church. And the church being the church is about the preaching of the word of God based upon the scriptures that proclaims Jesus Christ as the only savior of sinners. And so that's why he's willing to die for it.
Certainly, and he's willing to give up everything for that sake. And that was supremely misinterpreted, not only by liberals but especially by these peace at all cost guys. This what I call often the soft middle, where they see people like Machen, McCartney, others, especially the brothers that were involved with the Independent Board for Foreign Missions, and then eventually were run out of town because of their involvement and refusal to remove it. They were seen as just troublemakers. But Machen, these guys were not out to fight just for the sake of fighting. They weren't pugnacious, and that's forbidden. It's, that disqualifies you from ministry if you are pugnacious. But if you're not willing to fight for the fundamentals of the faith, to fight for the doctrine that we hold so dear, to fight for the Bible, then what are we fighting to uphold? What, why are we a group together? Why are we a church? If, because if we're not based on God's word and what God has commanded, what he's instructed, what he's done for us in history, then what foundation is there? And that's where it comes back often for a lot of these guys, just to political and social cultural influence. That it's really no different than in any other club or political party or that sort of thing. But for Machen, no, this is a supernatural body, the body of Christ, and if we can't compromise on our fun of, on our beliefs, as if we do, we've lost everything. We've ceased to exist. So, that's really the Auburn affirmation at 100. So my brother, thankful to my brother, was reading this article and he sent me a text. He said, "Hey, I just read your article on the Auburn affirmation." I said, "Oh, great. Thanks for reading that." He goes, "Yeah, it seems like nothing's changed." Well, we're thankful for faithful churches and we're not fighting these battles. We're fighting other battles in the OPC, but they're about whether we update the language of the confession to modern language, not... And no one on either side, as far as I can understand, has any intention or harboring any desire to change the substance of the confession. There's strong opinions and beliefs on both sides. There's many good people on all sides. I'm going to quote a former president here. when we put that in perspective, even though at General Assembly, sometimes we're left doing this and saying, "Oh, goodness, when's this debate going to end?" or "This is crazy." I'm so thankful for dealing with that stuff rather than what they were dealing with in 1923, 24, and following, especially in 36. But that being said, there's many lessons here to learn, and we should always keep on guard and maintain the faith, both confessional fidelity and integrity, and be unwavering in our commitment to our Savior and to His Word. So, Danny, thanks so much. We always love having you on, talking about the history of the Presbyterian Church in America, of America, I should say. I'm not speaking about the PCA, but the PC of A, and talking about the particularly the Northern Church. It'd be interesting to get a take on this. Maybe we can find a Southerner to see how the Auburn Affirmation was received down South, if at all. That'd be an interesting research question. Any thoughts on that?
Well, Marsden says that almost all the leaders had Southern roots in the fundamentalist side, and that it was not higher criticism. Others had not made the inroads that it had in the Northern Church.
Sure.
But I did, a pipe dream of mine, I don't know if that's the right language or not, but we have an episode with you, me, and Daryl Hart in which we would discuss H.L. Mencken, J. Gresham Machen, and Flannery O'Connor in the Christ-haunted South.
Let's do it. Let's do it in person. Let's find a reason where we can do that in person. If you're ever out in Chicagoland area, we can get Daryl to come around, or if we're in Michigan or something, we'll figure out a way to make it happen. So we'll post that for all the listeners and viewers. If you're interested in such things, let us know. You can encourage us. And if we get enough feedback, we'll put that much further ahead in the queue of potential episodes to come. But that's good. We appreciate it, Danny. We thank you for your service. Looking forward to seeing you in person again soon at General Assembly. A lot going on. Please pray for our church, the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, and pray for the faithful churches around the world. We're thankful for people willing to stand up and fight for the truth of the gospel. This is our calling, and this is the difficult aspect of ministry sometimes, but we need to do it. Head on over to reformforum.org, as I mentioned at the beginning of our episode, for more information about our programs, our courses, our events, our publications, and head on over to the donate page too if you're able and willing to help continue our labors here at Reformed Forum and spreading this message around the world. I do want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.